the Agile brand.
Welcome to the Delighted Customers Podcast, now part of the Agile Brand Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mark Slayton, and I am so glad you're here. I empower leaders to delight their customers, and I talk to guests with a wide range of expertise who share meaningful insights, wisdom, and practical tips that you can use immediately. I'm also excited to announce the Trusted Guide Roadmap Masterclass for CX leaders who struggle with executive buy-in and are ready to go beyond CX fundamentals. The masterclass gives you proven frameworks and takes you step by step through a four-step model that will move you past the frustration of not getting your work done. It's unique because it's live, interpersonal, hands-on, and we give you tools and templates to help you build your CX roadmap. To learn more, visit empoweredcx.com. That's empoweredcx.com. And now, on to the show. Well, this is going to be a fun episode. I am so excited to have my guest, Kevin Boodleman, on the show. Kevin is a former president of the IXDA and a design expert. He's the president of People Design, a design innovation firm. And he also teaches at Northwestern University and at Michigan State University in the Customer Experience Management Master's Degree program, along with me. Honored to be on the faculty with you, Kevin. Thank you so much. We're going to talk about design, what it means, get some definitions clear for some people, and talk about kind of why is it such a big deal? Why should people care about it? Why should business leaders care about it in addition to customer experience leaders? Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. I appreciate being asked. And this is a great opportunity to talk about ideas that I believe in. And your show is a terrific advocacy for customer experience and the program that we work together on. So happy to be here.
Excellent. And likewise. So I'm gonna ask you to start off by giving a 90 second or so. Just give us a quick background as to how you evolved and how you got into the world of CX and then what you're doing today.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I'm the co-founder of a company called People Design, which is based in Michigan. We work on design problems in the business strategy space, brand experience, and marketing activation. And I started that with a couple of partners more than 25 years ago. So overriding majority of my career has really been in sort of building this company. And, we've evolved quite a bit over that period of time. You know, the landscape of customer experience and technology and so on continues to change. And so I've kept myself busy, as you mentioned, being involved with the company, but also, you know, various industry boards like IXDA, a global organization. Wrote a book called Brand Identity Essentials about 10 years ago. It's in its second edition, and then do some teaching, as you mentioned. So, yeah, it's been... I got here sort of through the design world and technology world, and it's kind of led me to kind of the business world. And so I sort of play in all three spheres today.
Well, Kevin, I'm sorry I forgot to mention the book, Brand Identity Essentials. Sure. And when you wrote that book, what white space did you see that wasn't being addressed in the market?
So, it's interesting because, and this is, early enough that the internet was less mature than it is now. And so there were a lot of ideas that we were asked regularly by clients that we find ourselves in a sense teaching moments with clients, trying to help them think about the strategic and all the way down to the tactical elements of brand building. And so we know it was kind of an opportunity for us to express our point of view about these things and provide kind of in a sense a toolkit for brand managers and people trying to build, their brand awareness and build, and it kind of starts to bridge even into customer experience and so on, which I'll get into. But it was a way to kind of provide kind of a guide or a toolkit, less so for sort of people who themselves espouse to be brand experts, but business folks who a lot of times are clients who work on these problems on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. So Kevin, we're talking about design, and the term, there's a couple of terms out there: design thinking, human-centered design, user experience, which also UX, of course, CX, user research versus marketing research. Could you help define some of these things for us?
Sure. I can give it a shot. Yeah. It's interesting because I think that the word design can mean a lot of different things, of course. And so I got into this industry through kind of a design orientation, particularly with my undergraduate work, rather than a marketing orientation, at least from the start. And, you know, my early work was really design in the service of marketing, and it still exists today. But design can relate to marketing, but it relates to other things as well. And so, you know, at its core, design is about trying to think about the human needs, you know, designing for people, whether they're aesthetic needs or usability, ergonomic needs, that sort of thing. And sort of it's a different kind of a lens thinking about, you know, trying to better understand what people need and what they want, which, you know, it kind of overlaps the idea of market research. But, you know, the tradition kind of market research is a little bit different than user research. You know, market research kind of implies customers, which has an implication of their buyers, right? Whereas user research and designing for users can have a broader application. It can be about products, anybody who's using a product or a service, right? And so it kind of has a little bit broader envelope. And it also doesn't necessarily assume a commercial interaction. You know, it might be about better usability. It might be about, you know, being able to perform a certain function that isn't necessarily a, you know, a transactional one. So it sort of is a different kind of a lens. And I'm happy to sort of bring some of that thinking into the world of customer experience. And so I think, you know, among the things that looking at people as users as opposed to customers is it helps to bridge the gap to other kinds of audiences, for example. Like, a user can be a buyer, but they also may be sellers or influencers or employees, which bridges the gap between employee experience and customer experience to a degree. Some of the same kind of approaches allows you to sort of address different kinds of people. And so, you know, if you think about, the design sort of perspective is something that gained a lot of popularity, particularly as, you know, Apple, I think, is part of the poster child of a company that, you know, moved from bankruptcy to be being one of the most valuable companies in the world, or the most valuable for a time. You know, everybody started asking themselves, what was that really about when they didn't, and particularly in some of those cases, they didn't necessarily introduce new technology. It was really about experience and brand and other things, right? And so the emergence of this idea of design thinking, which is really trying to bring these kind of user-centered design approaches at scale within companies and trying to work on kind of collaborative processes have become more mature over the last decade or so. And as you mentioned, there are a lot of terms being floated around. So in the design world, people talk about user experience, and they're usually talking more like at a product level versus customer experience, which is kind of more of at a macro level. And other terms like interaction design and service design. And from my perspective, whether it's kind of micro or macro, everyone's kind of talking about trying to improve a customer journey. And from my perspective, human-centered design is just as a helpful lens for CX. Hmm.
So, for example, in your course at MSU, these are soon to be master's graduates in the CXM program. What do we want to impart to them as it relates to, you know, information around design?
Yeah, I think one of there are some macro forces at work here, I believe, and some of the material that I teach in my class is about how, you know, we're sort of shifting from an era that has been mostly defined by industrial processes, right? So the assembly line and kind of how we think about the nature of, you know, organizations today, how they function and how they work with their customer groups. And we're moving into this era that is more driven by technology, by information. And the way we think about it is an era of choice, and which is to say customers can really vote with their preferences and can through technology, new technology solutions. I mean, Amazon is a great example, of course, how, you know, it started to shift the historical monopoly powers that existed just by geography, for example, where people can choose to not go to their local bookstore and buy something online. And, you know, if you overlap streaming services and, you know, software service, all these things that have happened, it's never been cheaper to switch. You know, so the switching costs are low for customers. They have more and more options available to them. And so from my perspective, the experience that they have with these products and services becomes the one of the most critical parts of their relationship with any organization. And I think anybody who's sort of, you know, has already kind of drank the Kool-Aid on the CX world believes that, but I think it's more true today than even it was, you know, 50 years ago. And it's because of these other factors that are at play here. So from our perspective, starting to think about the human experience of it using these, you know, human-centered design approaches and kind of thinking through these kinds of problems is a way to create a stronger connection with their customers. And so ultimately customers will very often choose the easiest or best path, and they'll happily stop using your product and service for something else if it's better. And what does better mean? And, you know, the difficulty in making something better is, you know, sort of in many ways the stuff of CX. But trying to understand what's really behind those decisions on the human side is where I think, you know, the human-centered design approaches can play a role.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I think that we've come to the realization that the power shifted really to the customers from the businesses. And when we start, it's almost an empathetic approach of treating them like humans, right, trying to understand what it is they think, feel, how they use the product, how their experience will be enhanced. And I think about an example, an illustration that one of our professors in practice there in the faculty of MSU, Lou Carbone, in his mm-hmm. class and from his book, Clued In, you know, he talks about, and he's talked about Disney and the experience of Main Street. And some people may not know this, but Main Street in Disney is a human-centered design aspect to it, where as you're coming in, it goes, what it appears that it's a longer approach the way they designed it, right? Yeah. The width of the street, it changes from the beginning to the end. Yes. And the idea is to get out, they want to move you out quickly. So yes, the perception is that you're moving out quicker, and maybe there's some fact to it because the dimensions are a little different, but I think it's more about perception. And it's all about, you know, the journey from beginning till end. In that case, it's the day. Of course, the journey for a Disney experience starts way before you get to the park and way after you leave the park. But comment on that. Like, is that an illustration that would be applicable in the world of human-centered design?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's a great example. No, I think it's true. I think it's one of these things where I think we intuitively know this, but, you know, more and more of our existence in the world are made up of designed experiences. Like, you walk down the street, you work driving your car, you're using your television set, you take a train. Every one of these interactions is somebody, you know, whether they skillfully or not, intentionally or not, designed these things, right? So everything, all of these experiences are things that somebody has put this together. They had signage and cues, visual cues, verbal cues, spatial cues. And Lou's example of Disney is a great one, of course. And it's like, there are all kinds of interesting, you know, it's like the, I don't know if you're familiar with some of the hotels in Vegas, the windows are actually designed so that it looks like a traditional window with a, you know, like a mullion, like a, that you would see in a normal house, but it's actually two stories. You're actually looking at two stories, not just one story, just the window. And it's an optical illusion to make the building that look not as large as it actually is, because it's a massive building. Hmm. That's partly why when you're walking down the strip, it takes you like way longer than you think it does to get to that building, because it's actually farther away than it looks. There's a lot of things going on in the world that are not necessarily about deception per se, but they're clearly about perception. They're clearly, you know, and people are increasingly aware, you know, the makers of these physical environments and digital environments are aware of the dynamics of how, you know, in some ways we are affected by these interactions and these experiences. And I think organizations that are increasingly attuned to how to kind of think about these levers can use it to their advantage.
You know, you mentioned Vegas. You triggered a thought for me, because I'm imagining that there is a lot of human-centered design that goes into a casino. And absolutely. And I don't know if any of this is true. You might know more so than me, but I've also heard, like, from the floor where, you know, most of the money is being made and slot machines or the roulette, the blackjack tables, whatever, that you really can't see an exit. You can't see a window. You can't, there's no
clocks, no exits, no windows, just free drinks.
Just free drinks.
I mean, but yeah, so it's, these are choices. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's something. I think I also heard like something about ions and ionization. I don't know how that works. And then even the scent, like the odor as you come in is supposed to be pleasant. What do you know about like, whether it's a casino or some other public place that where they're appealing to your senses?
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's increasingly the forefront of a lot of in the sort of the, let's say, experience design world. People talk about, you know, all five senses. So we can talk about, again, visual cues, auditory cues. Certainly some of the big hotel chains, the fancier hotel chains, are definitely, they're working on scents in the lobby, you know, sounds, you know, even auditory design, which is to say, like, you know, if there's like a water treatment or something. I mean, these things are, they might even have acoustical masking properties so that you can have more privacy. I mean, these are all, they are, you know, this kind of gets into the stuff of architects and interior designers, but it starts to get into this kind of interesting soup of like, how do you deliver an experience? What is an experience? I mean, one of the articles we, you know, wrote several years ago was the idea that, you know, of course, in the design world, we tend to think that like we can design these experiences, and experience design is literally a phrase people use, but you can't actually design anybody's experience, right? All you can do is design these artifacts around the experience, hoping that you influence the experience, right? But it, again, goes to the fact that the experience itself is very human, right? It's internal to the individual. They're just perceiving things along the way. You can shape that experience by interactions that you can create. But yes, you can absolutely. One of the things that people talk quite a bit about these days are how to address all five senses.
Well, and Kevin, you don't just teach, you also practice, and you have a business that supports businesses who are looking to improve the client experience and improve business results. Can you think of an example of somewhere where you were brought in, there was an issue, and then you made a change that ended up in a positive outcome?
Sure. Well, so one of the things, you know, one of the things about user perception and user research, fundamental tenet of user research, is that you can ask people what they want, but they can't tell you what they need. Mm. And, you know, a great example, like nobody asked for an iPhone, right? I mean, no survey resulted in coming up with an iPhone. You know, The idea in the sort of innovation space in the design world is much more about trying to understand what they describe as unmet needs. Like, what is an unmet need, which is often an unarticulated need. In other words, no customer is asking for it. So to kind of answer your question, we've done a lot of projects where just about, let's say, product portfolio consolidation, which is to say, you know, companies over decades will survey their customers and they'll say, hey, you know, can you give us an evaluation on our products? What kind of, you know, what products do we need to add? And they're, you know, the answer is that they always add, you know, 10-20% more SKUs every year or something, something insane. So to the point where, you know, decades later, they've got a product portfolio that's unmanageable. It's, the team is overwhelmed. You know, the website is overwhelmed. The catalog is overwhelmed. The e-commerce system is overwhelmed. But it's because they keep asking people what they want, as opposed to trying to deliver what they possibly need. Now, again, that starts to sound a little authoritarian or something, but the truth is, if you can try to capture what customers actually need, you might deliver a better experience. So, in several cases, we've done basically culling a product portfolios to better understand, to reshape, you know, sort of the classic is kind of the 80-20, right, which is to say, which 20% deliver 80% of the value. And so that's just a nominal difference. But we've done that on various occasions where, you know, so for example, you know, you'll ask people what they, not only do they want more, but they want more choice. But the truth is, a lot of times when people are, you know, part of the one of the dynamics in this era of choice is that when presented with more choices, people tend to freeze, right? People, you ask people what they want and they say more choice. But when they have too many choices, they stop making any choices. So it's why actually having fewer choices and making it somewhat more understandable, comprehensible, and you could argue more human is a way to do that. So we've helped several organizations move forward in that vein by just trying to figure out how to better focus their product offering as a way to, you know, earn the same or better sales with less complexity internally. So which is an interesting, it has an impact on the customer experience, because basically this, how do I interact with this company? You know, it doesn't seem obvious on the surface, but the result is a more positive one.
Mm-hmm. And so what is the big deal? Like, if I'm a CEO, if I'm a business leader, all this design stuff is touchy feely. What would you say to that person?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, so I think that there are macro forces at work in terms of shifting from this industrial kind of economy. We sort of look at our businesses and we even look at our employees as a little bit like an assembly line has become kind of the metaphor of our time. So I think we look at hospitals this way. We look at schools this way, right? There's people coming in one side and people coming out the other side. And people, we're not widgets on an assembly line. People are not that way. You know what I mean? So, and I think the information economy has changed the dynamic. So as I say, I think that the fact that customers are more empowered to make choices forces organizations to have a better understanding as to how customers make choices, which is a human issue, really. You know, it has less to do with, in some ways, less about kind of macro market issues and sometimes almost more on an individual level. And, you know, I tend to think that, there are these big jobs to be done, so to speak, from a macro standpoint that a CEO or an organization needs to focus on. And one is around about brand meaning, and then the other one is about customer experience. And what's interesting about that from our perspective is that this is like practically nobody's job. Like literally, like very often there's nobody who's actually in charge of these two things, which I would argue are two of the biggest issues that are facing an organization today, at least in terms of developing top line growth. So now granted, customer experience and the program that you and I are involved with at MSU is, you know, this is one of the, and you know, this podcast and the subject of many books, it's an emerging practice, right? There is an emerging understanding of its value and why CX is even something we're talking about. And the same with brand. There are lots of people with brand in their title, but I would argue that they're kind of more umbrella messages or umbrella ideas. And so this human-centered design approach is ways to start to address these two kind of big tent poles, if you will.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking how would you begin to attack a problem? And I also think about what's one of the coolest projects that you worked on? let's just maybe do them both. Like what's one of the ones that maybe you're the most proud of or had the most fun with or think was the coolest, and how did you approach it?
Well, so we have a pretty standardized process for doing these things. I think it's starting with, you know, essentially, you know, user research as a way to start better understanding the nature of the problem and better, you know, kind of trying to find, as I mentioned, kind of the unmet needs and articulated needs, and then trying to deliver back solutions. So, I mean, I can talk about, you know, we've done work with a local university, for example, where we've done, it's interesting because the creative brief, if you will, going into it was, you know, had a number of things that they didn't want us to do. And I really realized later, my client reminded me that we violated like 3 out of 4 of the things they told us not to do, like, which included things like what your words to use and which logo to use and things like that. And we weren't trying to be difficult, but I think that trying to understand what are the boundaries of the box and trying to reshape that has been part of it. So, you know, we've been involved with campaigns and things that are a way to trying to deliver. So messaging, for example, and experiences that come from that. So nearly all of our projects, you know, start with kind of this research bit, and it kind of moves into kind of positioning, and then that positioning has an impact on the rest of the organization. So, you know, I mean, you know, we've had a lot of interesting success stories, campaigns like that, or, you know, helping an organization completely pivot in its focus, because they're trying to be all things to all people and trying to focus on it, which allows them a better lens to improve not only their brand, but their customer experience. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of examples. But.
Yeah. Yeah. The role of emotions, let's talk about that. Some people would argue, well, we really make decisions rationally. We're logical human beings. We can, but I'm guessing that you have something to say about that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting because I think the underlying message in this era of choice is that it's about trust. It's about making promises and keeping promises, right? Mm. So brand meaning is about making a promise. Customer experience is about keeping the promise, delivering value in a sense. And I think that what makes you trust somebody or something, that's a pretty squishy thing, mm. right? We tend to both use the assembly line as a bit of a metaphor for a lot of our work, but we similarly think of ourselves as almost like logical robots. And we're just, humans are not very logical. You know, we tend to be squishier than we like to think about ourselves. So on some day-to-day level, we make logical choices to navigate our way through our days, but just look at the political scene today or, or, you know, pop culture in general. We tend to make, you know, emotional intuitions and then sort of back them up with facts. Yeah. Now, some people might argue with me about that because of, you know, it's like they think of themselves as kind of embodying the scientific method or something, but like on a day-to-day basis, we don't do that. But there's been a huge, you know, increasing understanding of this in the marketplace, whether the rise of, you know, behavioral economics, behavioral science, you know, books about, if you're familiar with, you know, things like the two systems, thinking fast, thinking slow, and books about habit. There are several good books about habit formation and creation and so on, or cognitive biases. There are all these things that are increasingly well understood, but I don't think organizations haven't yet figured out how to operationalize and understand. And I think that the ones who do will succeed over the ones who don't. So, I mean, there are all kinds of interesting questions. I mean, things like, you know, it's like a credit cards work because it separates the pleasure from pain. Mm. Right. Right. So it's kind of there are all these interesting biases about, you know, from a customer experience standpoint, for example, you know, we tend to count negative experiences more, you know, maybe, you know, several times more than a positive one. Now, right. So how do you factor that into a customer experience evaluation when somebody gives you negative feedback? Well, it's because they remembered the negative one way more than the positive one. You know, they're much more likely to give you feedback on the negative one. Does that mean their overall experience was more negative? Not necessarily, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's just examples of like, especially in the CX world, there's a lot of desire for metrics and trying to understand the, you know, the patterns. I mean, and with good reason, but I think it's important to sort of recognize that the people that we are evaluating are themselves kind of not just one-dimensional characters that always respond in the most logical way. So better understanding them is a critical part of the work, in my view.
Yeah. That's a great point. I think Gerald Zaltman from the Harvard professor said that thinking all the decisions around, particularly around buying, are 95% are done in the unconscious.
Right. Right. Right.
And that's why emotions are so critical.
Yes.
To this. So designing experiences that connect to humans is so important.
Yeah. So trying to, you know, so if we're thinking about customer experience management, right? So like, what are we managing exactly? And what are we managing against? And how do we know if we're improving? I mean, it's not impossible, but it's definitely, it's a complicated affair. And trying to understand that, you know, understanding those customers is to say to understand those humans and their emotions, which is, you know, there's not necessarily a straight line there.
That's so true. That is so true. Well, as hard as it is, what recommendations, can you give us several recommendations on what you would say on how to design experiences for humans?
Sure. So, I mean, the first thing I just reiterate what I said a moment ago about, you know, people can tell you what they want, but they can't tell you what they need. And what I mean by that is far too much effort is put into surveys, you know, conducted in good faith, but also asking customers, say, what would you like us to do? And of course, the answer is you know, the customers don't really know what they want you to do. They want you to solve their problem, and they may not even fully understand their problem. So, yeah. You know, trying to understand, so digging in that on that level. So that's one. I guess another one, playing off that same idea, I think you should seek to better understand the internal motivations and tracking behaviors and perceptions, and essentially trying to understand those underlying incentives that are feeding into your customer's decision-making process is something that is should be an ongoing exercise. I think it's, you know, one of the things, I mean, we can talk about Google and what that's become as an organization, Alphabet, I suppose, these days. But, you know, among the things that they have over most other companies is that they have a much better understanding, a more robust understanding of their customers than anyone else, which I think, you know, the ones who understand their customers the most are going to win in the long term, I believe. So like having a three-dimensional understanding of your customer and not just kind of a very kind of one-dimensional, you know, quantitative understanding is good. So then another one is to think about, and again, it goes into customer decision-making. Customers also, all people, we tend to have a sort of a self-identity, whether or not we think about it explicitly or not, which is to say, you know, I identify as an individual, I identify myself as a group, as part of a, you know, a confab of some sort, whether it's my family or the company I work with or what clubs I belong to, what sports, what activities I participate in. We all kind of, but again, whether or not we think about it consciously, we walk around thinking, I'm the kind of person who would, or I'm the kind of person who would, like, I'm, you know, I wouldn't wear that kind of shirt. You know, I'm the kind of guy who would drive that kind of car, which is a, and again, we don't think about it consciously necessarily, but there's an internal narrative that we're telling ourselves. So, you know, what, among the things we work with our clients on is trying to understand, like, how does your brand narrative fit into their personal narrative, in a sense? The way we look at it, customer experience is an extension to that narrative. It's actually delivering on the narrative. If the brand is the promise, the customer experience is delivering on that promise. So how is the customer experience actually extending and delivering on the sense of self-identity? So like there's an identity of a company and an identity of an individual, and how do these things kind of overlap? So again, those are just a few ways, I guess, to sort of think about it, but it hopefully brings some additional insights into customer experience.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, Kevin. I think about this idea of Simon Sinek talks about the golden circle and the why, and right. They don't buy right. from you because of what you make or how you make it, but why, you know, what is your mission and does it connect with my mission, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's very interesting too, because, and I, you know, I'm a fan of his, and I think that but I will say it's interesting how, especially in this kind of, you know, this sort of political polarization that goes on in these days, you know, in terms of like, what is why mean? What is purpose? Like a lot of companies talk about their purpose and so on. And I do think that and the way he talks about that concept is important and valid. But I also think there's lots of different levels of whys too. Like, so I think part of it is like, you know, even like when we dig in, not to get too kind of transactional about it, but it's like sometimes when we're digging into what's the motivation, the why, so to speak, why a customer will behave a certain way or not. Sometimes it's just like, I just want to look good in front of my boss, mm-hmm. which is, again, they're not going to say that to you, but that's what they're trying to do. Right. So right. It's kind of like, and again, it's not to diminish what Simon Sinek is trying to say with this start with why and so on, but there's different, I do think that what inherently there is like these intrinsic motivations as to how people make decisions. I think he's right about on a more macro level, people are aligning themselves with brands that they believe in. And that's, again, it's an artifact of this era of choice. If I can buy a book from five different places online and they're all kind of the same, which one do I buy a book from? So, or watch TV from, or whatever the service or product is. So it does play a role in terms of like that level of higher level why is kind of more ties into the personal identity piece.
Yeah. I'm going to do my best to put a bow on the conversation, and you tell me if I'm totally lunatic. what I heard really is that human-centered design is in a current modern day outcome of a shift from industrial age, where assembly line factory, you know, that was production was driving what consumers had to choose from. Now there's been a shift. The shift is the consumers have lots of choices, and that is a motivation for CEOs, if they want to protect their business or grow their business, to be the best choice in the mind of the consumers. And by deeply understanding what it is, not necessarily what customers say they want, but what they need, and then responding to that, and the connection between the brand promise, which is what we're saying we're about, what we're promising we're about, and then the customer experience, which is delivering on that promise, right? It is connecting the dots between those two, realizing that there's a ton of emotion in the middle of all that. And so even trying to nail down or peg, you know, that even if the best you can do is try and generalize about that, because even consumers' motivation really from day to day, depending on the product, then we talked about sort of this day to day over chronologically, their needs change, but also like levels, depending on where your product fits into the, you know, I may buy from a certain mulching company because of their environmental mission. But when it comes to, you know, I don't know, toothpaste, I really don't care about their environment. I just care about what it tastes like in my mouth. Am I getting close?
Absolutely. No, that's a wonderful summary. Thank you. No, I think that's exactly it. And I would just add that I think that a lot of times people can also start to think about it as isolated to the consumer business.
Yeah.
But the reality is we do a lot of work in the B2B space. And I think that the same, so like if we think that we're logical in general, like logical human beings, or not so emotionally driven, that tends to be even doubly so in the B2B space. We have this perception that we're going to make these really logical choices. And I have found that to be not really as true as we think it is. I mean, obviously there are some clear metrics, price, et cetera, but you know, there's a reason why there are these cliches about, like, you know, nobody ever got fired for hiring IBM. Or nobody ever got fired for doing, you know, it's like eventually became Microsoft or whoever else. I think what they're really doing is they're basically relying on trust. There wasn't anything in the proposal that they were relying on. It was the fact that it was the brand perception and the belief that that organization is going to do them a solid. So I think I think that's a great summary. I would just add that the B2B space is not different in that way. In fact, I would even argue that the B2B space and B2C space is getting increasingly blurry.
Yeah. Yeah. And trust is something that's near and dear to my heart. In my course at MSU, we start off, it's customer relationship management. So we spend the whole first module really talking about trust from a bunch of different angles. And then the masterclass that I offer is called the Trusted Guide Roadmap.
There you go.
and the idea there is twofold. One is, as a CX leader, if we're trying to make change, we really need to be trusted. And two is, yeah, the last part of that is about proving the value of CX, and there's different ROI models. But if you aren't trusted first, you're going to have people can find reasons there's something wrong with your proposal. They can always, if they don't like you, they don't trust you, they don't, whatever, there's a whole bunch. A friend of mine who wrote the Trusted Advisor book, Charlie Green, says it's really more than that. He would use the word, what does he say? Convenient fiction. That logic, even in the C-suite, logic plays the key role. But really, if you think about it, if you, Kevin, if you've got a project that you're working on that is going to save an organization, let's say it's a culling of products and you're going to consolidate the number of SKUs mm-hmm. and save them money by not carrying inventory or whatever's cost associated with that. Right. The old 80-20 rule. Mm-hmm. And someone else, maybe even you, have a different idea. Another idea is to change the design of the way they order. Mm-hmm. One's going to save them X%. The other's going to save them Y%. And there really the decision sounds like apples to apples, but it really could be touching on two completely different planes. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah. And then, you know, emotion's going to come into it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, absolutely. I mean, among the, like when we work on, and you know, this is not unique to us, but certainly this broader space about customer experience, you know, journey mapping and so on. I mean, we look at it as a, if you look at it as a series of interactions, those interactions are not, they're not equal, right? So in the customer's mind, they're not equal. Like it's possible you can fail on two or three, but if you fail on this one, it's, you know, it's life or death in terms of your relationship with that customer. And so like understanding that, again, on paper, they look the same, but they're not the same in the customer's mind. And then also it layers into things like, you know, you're again, your brand positioned, you know, so it's like your classic, you know, and back when FedEx was relatively new and they, I think their slogan was something like when it absolutely has to be delivered overnight or something like that. Right. Well, if they failed on that point, everything else doesn't matter. Right. So there's, is an interesting, so not all interaction is the same, you know, and I thought, you know, so to your point, there's a question of like, ultimately you can always invest in every one of those interactions across the board. But if they both need investment, how do you choose where to invest? I mean, these are important questions. And a lot of that is, it can be, you know, related to the customer's perception through that journey. You know, where is their greatest pain point, which might not be your greatest pain point. So trying to align those things becomes critical.
Well, so much fun talking about this stuff. I got an education, as I always do. Learning. If you are listening and you're interested in broadening your education horizon, professors like Kevin, who also teaches at Northwestern, right?
That's right.
Yeah, is an expert and someone who, you know, I certainly wish I had taken your class before I became a CX practitioner.
Likewise.
But just a plug for the MSU CXM Master's Program. If you're thinking about it, either of us would love to talk to you more about it. Last question I have for you, because we do need to land the plane here, is what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
That's a good question. It's funny because so my son is 20. this is in the forefront of my mind. I think it's interesting because a lot of the concepts that I teach through both courses that I teach in some ways are things that I wish I had learned earlier in my career. So like that, there's a plug for any of that. That's part of that is trying to, you know, things that I have found valuable. But I guess a few things is the importance of communication. You know, I teach in some of my classes the, you know, some of the basics of communication theory and how communication is 50% sender, 50% receiver, meaning is co-created in the middle. We tend to think about communication as a broadcast, but again, that kind of goes to the need for understanding the recipient. I think we sort of know this in our personal lives, but that's, it's useful in business and it's useful in your career and so on. So I think it's an important tenet that I try to lean into myself. Another one would be, I think trying to instill that, you know, the learning is for you and not for others. I don't know if you had this experience, but like, there's one thing when I went through undergrad is when I was 20 versus when I went to graduate school. And part of it is a question of like, who's writing the check, right? But yeah. It's also just a life stage question of like realizing that at some point I didn't really need a degree. You know, I was interested in the content. And I guess not everybody's in that place. I'm sort of by self-employed and so on. But it's a critical part about your, thinking about learning is broadening your world and sharpening your focus. And it goes beyond grades and accolades. You know, I think that's a critical piece. And I guess the third thing I'd say is that, you know, it's important to kind of recognize that the world you grow up in is not the world you're going to occupy. And I guess that is to say that, you know, we tend to think about the world as kind of a snapshot, or we have certain moments of like when we're high school or college or get a job, but like things are, especially these days, are moving so quickly. There's an undercurrent of change. And so I've become much more of a fan of trying to identify, you know, look for the changes instead of the facts themselves in a sense, because the facts are going to change on the ground, so to speak. But the macro forces are at work, and I think that becomes useful. So trying to maintain some perspective on that is helpful.
Ah, great, great words of wisdom there. K, Kevin, thank you so much for being on the show. It's an honor to, as I mentioned before, to have you on the show and to be on the faculty with you at MSU. And thanks again.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Mark. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Delighted Customers Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode or any of my other ones, hit subscribe or follow. I've got a lot of other great guests that are coming up and a lot of other great content. I don't want you to miss anything. You can find any links or references on the show in the show notes, and you can find those at my website at empoweredcx.com. That's empoweredcx.com. Also, make sure to check out the other shows in the Agile Brand Podcast Network by going to www.agilebrandguide.com. The Delighted Customers Podcast with Mark Slayton is produced by Missing Link, a Latina-owned, strategy-driven, creatively-fueled production co-op. From ideation to creation, they craft human connections through intelligent, engaging, and informative content.
The Agile Brand.